Hey, thank you. All right. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. We will go right ahead with the approval of the agenda, but before that, I want to remind you that this is being audio recorded. And the times shown on the agenda are estimates only. So to approve the agenda, we do have one notice, and that is that our Chief Quality Officer, Randy Manuel, is otherwise occupied with other work schedules and won't be able to report today. So we will take that off the agenda. And otherwise, is there any other change for the agenda that anyone might have? If not, then maybe we have a motion to approve as amended.
Move to adopt as amended.
Okay. Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor, raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Passes. And now we're going to the patient story. Is Tina available yet? I know she's been detained a little bit, but if she's not here, we'll go ahead and go to the minutes. No, we'll go to public comment. Excuse me. So is there any member of the public that would like to comment? See, there are a few people here. Were there any emails or snail mails that have come in, people that wanted to comment, Christina?
No, none.
Is there anyone in the conference room that might want to comment? Do we know if we have any?
We don't have anyone in the conference room either.
Okay, all right, then. If there's nobody that wants to comment, I will move on then. Last chance. Okay, we'll go ahead for the approval of the February 28th special session minutes. Is there a move to approve?
So moved.
Okay, Matt, and then Mari, will you second?
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor, raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay, minutes approved as written. Required approvals, we have one correction under the resolution 23-03 canceled warrants should be 2304, and that has been corrected. Is there, other than that, do you have any comments, Mari?
For the minutes? No, I don't. For the minutes?
No, these are for required approvals.
Oh, required approvals. Yes, there is a one delay, move to the next MedExec meeting is one of our providers. It's just pushed to next month. And that's Dr. Levy.
Okay. Is there a move to approve the required approvals?
Move to approve them as amended.
Okay.
And I will second as amended.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? I'll raise your hand if you say aye.
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 Okay.
Aye.
Done. Now, is Tina here yet? No, I don't see her. Okay, we'll go to Heather. Is Heather here? Or the interim chief human resources officer.
I didn't see her here yet.
So okay. I think the board, we're like in middle of day two of D&D survey, which is at its most intense period. So I feared availability of staff would be scattered, and my fears are coming true.
Okay.
But I will poke my head and see where folks are.
All right. hold on a little bit and see. This is way ahead of what they our schedule. So.
And is that because we eliminated the education portion?
Yes. Or? Yes. We didn't have any. If you recall, we were talking about not having that if we didn't have anything germane. So we didn't this time.
And that could be throwing staff off as well, because they usually anticipate our meeting starting at 3:30.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wonder if Tyler is here.
We could choose to forego those reports and hear them next month.
Yes, we could, if especially under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Let me see. It's just sort of a wild day today. No worries. Be free.
Is there anything urgent to your knowledge that the board should hear from those reports that couldn't wait until next month?
Well, certainly the quality report can be delayed. You should probably hear the finance report, and it's ready. So as soon as we find Tyler, I think we're good to go there.
Would you like to do your administration report then?
How about if we do Tina's? I'm trying to chase folks. Give me a second to chase to see if I can find if people are in DMV activity
Tina.
Or where they're at. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Tina. Apologize. I'm so sorry. I was running behind.
Well, no apology necessary. It's a weird day. So
and you're running ahead.
Okay. Well, good afternoon. I actually had two thank you notes that I wanted to share with you. And these are always, they both had that that experience for a patient where there are so many different people in different departments impacted their stay and just how they felt as a patient. So those are always my favorite. And I want to share two of them because we had so many thank you notes in this last month. So the first one is to the awesome team at Jefferson Healthcare, from our first step in the door to discharge and beyond, you all were absolutely wonderful. Your excellent teamwork, professionalism, respect, and compassion for myself and my family were truly outstanding. A huge thanks to each of you individually, but I will have forgotten some names, I'm sure. Thank you so much to CJ, Kevin, Sarah, Paul, Marcia, Tabitha, Lynn, Christy, Catherine, Matthew, Michael, Matt, Andrew, Peter, Todd, Aaron, Lauren, Leslie, Paige, Dr. Tirado, Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Bowman, and so many others. Everything each of you did made what would have been an otherwise painful experience so much more bearable. Thank you for being a beacon of excellence on the Olympic Peninsula. And it's signed LMAO, laughing my appendix off. So I thought it was clever, and just that so many people made an impact to that patient. And then the second one, again, a patient that traveled throughout our clinics, ER, surgery, inpatient services. I'm writing to thank you for helping me during my acute gallbladder attack and later bradycardia. I've been a traveling nurse for 40 years before needing to retire. My wife had a chronic illness that often ended up with us sitting in emergency departments, of which at times I also worked. So when I say that I was pleasantly surprised at the level of respect, courtesy, and true compassion I encountered at your ED, I am speaking from a place where this is so very rare. From the receptionist who greeted me out front, the lab and radiology team, nurses, techs, and the doctors were all in my book exceptional people. Thank you for demonstrating what a well-functioning, humane ED looks like. Thank you for being you. So well done to all of our teams.
That's great. All right. Thank you, Tina. That's an uplifting story for everybody, and congratulations and thank you to all those people that were mentioned, especially.
Thank you.
Okay, Tyler, I see your initials on the board. That must mean that you're here. Are you ready for your...
I am here. Sorry. Okay. I did not know that I was going to be jumping on so soon.
Well, we kind of shortened the meeting, and that's not your fault. So thank you for being accommodating.
Yep. No worries. If Christina, can you pull up the presentation?
Absolutely. I'll share that now.
Thank you. And I'm happy to report this is one of those finance reports that Mike loves. It's pretty boring. We had another good month to start out the year. So so far, you know, I've mentioned this before, but when we do our budgets, we take the total amount of expected gross revenue and expenses for the year, and we just divide those by 12 and kick them out, and we divide them by the days of the month, and then push them out that way. So it is completely split. It's not flexed. There's no seasonality. There's no, you know, we takes a while to ramp up in January, February. So usually, and when I'm you know, giving a January or February presentation, we haven't quite made it to where we were expecting to be yet. We're still working towards getting to that higher number, and we're a little bit short. But that hasn't been the case so far in January and February of 2023. Our numbers, our stats, and our revenue have been pretty on target so far. So here's our operating stats. We are a little bit short of where we wanted to be for FTEs, but we're above where we were at this time last year. Adjusted patient days, our overall marker for indicator for volume, 12% over budget and 28% higher than last year. And that's driven by both our patient days, which patient days were 9% over, and then all of our outpatient activity. And outpatient activity, you can see down below, we most departments were doing well, either above their budget or at least above where they were in February of 2022, and trending in a good direction to start off the year. So next slide. So gross patient service revenue, we ended up 1% over budget. If you looked at the individual breakout, it was, you know, some exceptional budgeting that happened, because we were $970 off our outpatient revenue number, which is pretty funny, because that's a $23 million number, and to only be $970 off is a pretty incredible. We probably won't get that close for the rest of the year on any of those, but gross patient service revenue for the month was over. For the year to date is pretty close to where we expected, just $223,000 short of budget. Revenue adjustments where we expected as well. Other revenue, we are in the detailed packet, you can see that the 340B revenue was over budget for the month, and slightly over budget for the year, but also short of where we were last year at this time. And so we're actually going to discuss 340B and contract pharmacy and some of the things that are happening at the finance committee tomorrow. Dive a little bit further into the weeds of that. But the manufacturers are trying to limit our 340B, make us jump through hoops, and we've got some plans to try and hopefully get that revenue number back up. But so far, at least, it's been over our budgeted amount. So for total operating, 3% over for the month, 1% for year to date, and we are still under budget on salaries and wages. That's because we're short on FTEs, as I just showed on the last one. Same with employee benefits. Other expenses are higher, and that's going to be driven by the contract labor that we're having to hire, and also supply expense. We have quite a bit of additional supply expense, and I'm hoping that as we're doing a lot of work around pharmacy, pharmacy is obviously a big driver of the supply expense. They are very expensive drugs, very costly, and it's such a big piece of our overall book of business that it's a significant driver of the cost as well. So I'm hoping as we dive into that further that that number will drop, but so far it is pretty high, and it's been climbing a little bit faster than the revenue has from pharmacy.
Excuse me, Tyler?
Yep.
Yeah, on my screen, I can only see salaries and benefits, but nothing below. Is that my problem, or is that...
Can see it. I don't know if anyone else can see below salaries, wages, and benefits. I can see other expenses, total operating, all the way down to the operating margin.
I can see that, as you say, Tyler.
Okay. In that case, it's my own personal computer problem.
Sorry about that. Hopefully, you might be able to pull up the PDF that gets sent out, too. But I'll walk through what the rest of the numbers are below that, just so you know as well. But total operating expenses ended up 2% above our budget, but operating income 37% higher. Non-operating income is still significantly higher than what we expected, and that's driven by the high interest rates that are causing additional investment income from the local government investment pool, which is all very much rate driven. And so we had $142,000 of investment income in the month, and we only budgeted for $15,000. So we usually get very, very little in investment income, and the high rates have driven that up pretty considerably. Overall, change in net position, $625,000. Budget was $362,000. For year to date, we are over $1 million in change in net position, and we budgeted $764,000. So operating margin 3.2% and total margin of 4.1%. So all pretty good numbers considering the just the healthcare landscape and, like I said, how we usually start off the year. Next slide. So days cash, days in AR, these have held pretty flat from the last few months. We did bump up that days cash goal to over 100 for the year, and we're exceeding that right now. We're at 109, and the once you add in the amount that we expect to get from Medicare as a receivable that we have on our books right now, that jumps up to 111. And days in AR have been flat at around the 52 range. We do have some additional billers, cash posters that we just hired recently, and I'm hoping we start to see that number drop again. There's a few things that have impacted that, one just being that we've been a little short on that team, and so getting more bodies in, we should be able to post the cash that we're receiving faster. And another is payers have just really done even more to try and slow pay and no pay for the activity that we have. And so you can see our net collection rate has dropped slightly. And so we're having to, you know, scrap and claw for all that is owed to us from those payers. And so we get some more bodies in, hopefully we'll have some more resources to throw at them, because they definitely have the resources to try and deny and keep our payments low. Next slide. And then March, same story. So March so far is sitting at 99.3% of budget, is the forecast as of this morning. Cash collections, 375. Our goal is 417. Like I said, we've got some new cash posters, new patient account reps on the team. Hopefully that that number keeps driving upwards. And with that going up, the 52.9 days in AR should drop as well. So far, a pretty good start to the year, but also some opportunities for us. So we're going to continue to work those. Any questions?
Good.
Great report.
So we're going to try to stimulate more board discussion and bi-directional engagement during these board meetings. We're going to tee up some questions starting next month, but I think given that we may have a little extra time, I can start that now. I think a good question for the board to ask with respect to finance is when we step into this project in a real serious way, and we have been directing a lot of cash toward the pre-development of and positioning for the project, but to direct a significant portion of cash to the financing of the project and keep our minimum level of days in cash on hand is going to challenge us. So I think a reasonable question from the board is, are we planning for that? Are we concerned about financing $10 million of the project, or $8 to $10 million, whatever the number ends up, out of our cash reserves, and yet maintaining our an adequate level of cash? So that's a question that I think would be entirely reasonable for the board to ask us, given we're stepping into this construction project. So Tyler, you wanna tackle that?
Yeah, and I actually, Mike didn't prep me for this, but I had a spreadsheet that I was working on that I can to share to walk through it as well. So, you know, in addition to the feasibility study and the work that we're doing with DZA, we're also talking about different ways that we can track our cash and see, you know, where we expect to land at the end of the year, and also cleaner ways of making sure that we're not, either paying for the project and thinking that our cash reserves are being depleted and beating up on our revenue cycle more than we need to, because actually that's just part of the expected drop, or that we're not giving ourselves too much credit when the proceeds come in from debt. And so how can we kind of parse those two things out and just look at cash from operations and the building project kind of separate? But so we've been talking about that. But this is a spreadsheet that shows, just the usual formula that you have for days cash, which is starting off with your cash, going through and saying what's your expected revenue from the year, what's your expected operating expenses. These are all our budgeted numbers, non-operating. add back in interest, depreciation, amortization. Those are expenses that do not have a cash value to them. You know, as our buildings depreciate, yes, that is causing expense on our income statement, but we are not paying anything out in a given year. Adding those back in to get our expected earnings before interest, depreciation, amortization. Adding in the uses, I had in this spreadsheet, you know, that we have our usual debt service payments. We're also going to have some new construction, and then we've got our non-construction capital. Assuming that is 4.5 million throughout the year, and our daily operating expenses are 420,000, we should land at the end of the year at 111 days cash. So this is obviously missing a lot, but this is saying, you know, if we were to have, if we were to spend everything that we expected to spend in our capital budget, which is 3.4, if we're to spend an additional 4.5 on CIP and nothing else happens, we should be in a good spot at the end of the year. If we're able to hit our revenue expectation and our expense expectation. Obviously, if we're not able to hit one of these, if revenues are lower or expenses are higher, that's gonna throw a wrench in it, right? And so we can kind of tweak this and change our assumptions as we go through the year of are we on target for revenues, or are expenses continuing to climb? Are we going to spend more than we expected in CIP throughout the year? And when are our debt proceeds going to start to come in, and what, how much is that, and what does that look like? So we are tracking this from a variety of different ways, just to make sure that we do maintain our over 100 days cash. And I even shared with the team, I mean, really, it's over 110 days. You know, we want to keep that number as close as we can to what S&P Standard & Poor's considers an adequate amount of days cash on hand, which is over 110.
So, Tyler, one question on, I saw the non-construction cash is like 3 something million. Is that like equipment for
that's all the that should be everything that's not related to the, and there might be a little bit of crossover, but it should be everything that's not related to the new building project that we earmarked for a capital expenditure in 2023.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, that's a question that I had too. So that is not related to this new project. Is that correct? And then also, I think I saw a date on top of that of January. Were those the actual figures for the month of January? And then your expectation is you would do that once a month?
Yep. So that was just a roll forward to say, here's what we had at the beginning of the year, and if the year ends how we expect it to, this is what it would look like. Now, and what we would do is go in and say on a monthly basis, are we meeting those expectations? So, you know, does it look like we're going to be able to hit that revenue and expense budget? Have we ended up paying more for construction than we expected? But we can go through and use that to calculate what our expected end of year cash is going to be on a monthly basis.
And I think I saw one bunch of numbers that also included debt payments and that kind of thing. Is that right? Is that the one that also includes the depreciation, or is that a different one?
No, the debt service payment is our actual payment that we have on all of the debt that we have as of today. So it's not including the new debt that we would be taking on as part of this project. That's just all of the financing that we currently have.
And when does that new debt start, and where would that show up?
So that would start as soon as, you know, we're working through the USDA process right now, but we would sometime in the fall, you know, finalize with a little earlier than the fall, but everything would kind of, you know, wrap up around that time frame of the bridge loans that we would get with a bank, and then also the financing with USDA. And so there's a lot of there's a lot to be determined on those. You know, how much is each and what rate is each and what do the payments look like still needs to be determined as we work through this process. And that's why I didn't include it in there. This was a, you know, separate from all of the money that we're going to bring in and start to pay out for the project. This is just, you know, if we made it through the end of the year and we didn't, we paid everything that we expected, but we hadn't started the new project yet, where would we end? And that's what is showing up so far on that spreadsheet.
But that other information gets added to the same spreadsheet, doesn't it?
Yeah, as soon as we know more, we would add it in. Yeah, yeah, that's correct.
Any other questions? Oh, Mike, did you have something?
Well, just a comment. I think that this is something that we have been wringing our hands about a lot for the last year. Now that as some of the variation of the variables is starting to be removed, we're getting a better idea of what the problem that we are going to have to solve or the challenge that we're going to have to overcome. I didn't expect Tyler. I know Tyler has been thinking about this because we've been talking about how we can show it to you. I didn't expect him to have that much of a head start on it. But for the next couple of months, we're going to be monitoring this, and then we will have a point in time where, you know, I keep showing you sources of funding for the project with buckets of cash, foundation, federal, state funding, and debt. And when we're going through some financial analysis now with Tom Dingus, Dingus Zetacor, and some other consultants to not only help us understand our current financial position and our debt capacity, but also what a pro forma for the new businesses that we will be adding and revenue streams that come along with them that identifies those revenues and the expenses and ultimately the cash that's thrown off. So there will be an opportunity to revisit what those proportions of the buckets look like. Like, hey, you know what? With this new project, we're going to have it's going to produce a lot more cash than thought. So because we have grown so much and our debt has stayed the same over the last few years and actually reduced, we've got more debt capacity than we thought and still staying under that responsible line. Do you want to throw less cash at it and borrow more? Those will be decisions that we will be able to make up until, I don't know, 2-3 months from now when we have to lock it in with the USDA. So our thinking is that we will begin to, now that we're getting a better idea of what the numbers and process could possibly look like, we're gonna be giving you monthly doses and educate ourselves along the way so that we will be as informed as we can be when it comes down to, you know, banker sitting across from you, you know, how much do you want to borrow? Okay. Great. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you, Tyler. Thanks, and thank you for being so quick to come to the meeting. I know it was a lot earlier than what we'd figured, but we appreciate it. Thanks. Okay. Is that conclude your report then, Tyler? Okay. Is Heather here yet?
No, I don't think she's available. I could slide into my administrative report now, Jill.
Okay. Thanks, Tyler. All right. We'll have Mike Glenn, our CEO, with his administrative report.
All right. I'm going to channel Dunya and start with advocacy. And if these slides look like Dunia's work, it's because they are. A quick update on what's going on at the state. 1 month to go in the legislative session, you'll recall that the top four priorities that Dunia shared a couple of months ago is the Jefferson Reproductive and Gynecological Health Expansion Project that we are, we had a $3 million appropriations included in the governor's budget, and now we are working to get that appropriations included in the House and the Senate budget as well. It's a high priority for the rest of the session. Second was difficult to discharge patients. Probably the biggest obstacle, but there are well-meaning people who would think this isn't an obstacle, but a safeguard. But from the perspective of a hospital trying to discharge a patient, it can be an obstacle, and that is the guardianship issue. And as you may be aware, a guardian being assigned to either a patient who has been determined to be incapable of making important decisions on their own, or there are no other family members to help them with that, which is a wonderful service to provide. The difficulty is sometimes if you're starting from the beginning, that process can take months, and the patient that is in the hospital that does not have a medical reason to be in the hospital, but cannot be discharged to home, we have to wait until that guardian has been assigned to the patient before we can engage in discharging. And truly, that's a legal process that sometimes takes a month to 2 months just to get on a court's docket. So we were hoping to make progress with that, but because you want to make that process move more expeditiously, but not at the risk of lowering those safeguards and making sure that every patient has a voice and an advocate in where that discharge is. So I understand the reason for the deliberate pace with this, but it still creates difficult to discharge patient issues. Secondly, providing more funding for difficult to discharge patients to nursing homes, memory care facilities, psychiatric facilities for patients that require extra layers of resources. And the good news is it looks like there will be additional funding for these patients, and I will speak more to the not so good news when I get to the SNAP program. Next is maintaining flexible staffing models and innovative ways to support nursing staff. What we maintained from the beginning is that we work real hard, Tina and her nurse leadership team, and the nursing team that participates in the staffing committee. We have worked really hard over the years to make that an effective and productive committee. And sometimes the discussions that are had in that group are robust and sharp. But the issues that we are trying to wrestle as the whole state and country are beginning to realize are challenging. But the whole point is let's create a venue where there can be open and respectful dialogue. And together, let's figure this out, because we maintain that staffing solutions are best made local by the caregivers and the support teams and the leaders of those caregivers. rather than through an outside entity. So our staffing committee, I think, has worked well over the years. Each year they produce a document, a staffing plan that they agree on, and they send to me and I sign off on. So we have treated our staffing plan like a compact. We have treated our staffing plan like it was the racial rules of the road, and on a daily basis work to meet that plan. And the vast majority of the time we do. So the negotiated solution to the nurse ratio bill that was advancing is basically the staffing plans that are produced in hospitals across the state will become their ratios. And there will be levels of responsibility and accountability for meeting those staffing plans. And hospitals need to meet the plans 80% of the time by unit, or they will receive a technical consultation from Department of Labor and Industries. What's the problem? How can we help you meet the staffing plans that your staffing committee of administration and bedside caregivers decided was most appropriate. Now, critical access hospitals and some small rurals like Olympic and Harbor and I think a few others, we are exempt from reporting. But as I mentioned earlier, that the staffing plan that we come up with that is produced by the staffing committee, we treat that like it's a contract and work really hard to meet it. Whether we are reporting on a monthly basis, we are required to report on a monthly basis or not, our commitment to meeting the staffing models that we pledged we would meet is very strong. So we were encouraged that when it was a negotiated settlement between representatives from organized labor and representatives from WSHA, and two, that the staffing plans continue to stay local and developed by the hospitals and employees at the hospital that will be taking care of patients. Next is the safety net assessment program. And this is, I will try to give an uncomplicated description of what this very complicated program is. But basically, organizations that see a disproportionate level of Medicaid patients, because it's recognized that Medicaid typically reimburses at a below cost level, can make application to the federal government and qualify for matching dollars that for the purpose of breaching that gap or filling that gap. The entire state, so all hospitals in the state, are currently participating in a SNAP program at a modest level. Progressive payment hospitals, PPS hospitals, haven't received an increase in their Medicaid reimbursement in over 20 years. So that gap has grown significant during that time or over that time. But yet the money trickling in for the purpose of filling that gap hasn't grown. Well, this year, all the hospitals have agreed to, in essence, tax ourselves more, so that the amount of funding we send to Washington, D.C. Is greater, and then therefore the matching dollars that come back from Washington, D.C. are greater. All hospitals, including Jefferson Healthcare, will receive more SNAP funding beginning April of next year because of this program. And to many hospitals, this is a lifeline because they are taking care of patients that reimburse at a at whose insurance reimburse at a below cost level, and you can only do that for so long. So it's a great program for every hospital in the state, and including Jefferson Healthcare. Now, in order for us to, that we have to participate and the state has to participate. So both the hospitals and the state have to be willing parties to this. So you can imagine that makes for an interesting negotiation. Part of what the state said to us is, hey, look, you are also asking for help on the difficult to discharge patients, in particular, additional dollars for post-acute facilities. Because of our involvement in this program, you're going to be receiving significantly more dollars from SNAP. We recommend, how about if we allocate a portion of these new dollars coming into the state and direct those to funding for some of these organizations that can accept these difficult to discharge patients. So on the one hand, we're thinking, well, wait a minute, we're not in the business of funding nursing homes and memory care facilities and other post-acute organizations. But on the other hand, it indirectly impacts us. And that in order to make this thing go forward, both parties had to compromise. So it looks like we have agreed on what that allocation of the total amount coming back will be. That Eric Lewis, who is the CFO of Wishaw, and the folks that are working closely on this, and Tyler has sat in on some subcommittees for this, agree that, yeah, this is fair and reasonable. And the desired amount of extra funding for Jefferson Healthcare and all the hospitals meets what we, what we had targeted. SNAP, which there's been an agreement in principle, and now just additional discussions and committee votes to get this done. But the agreement in principle has been reached, and it looks like this is going to come together. I'm actually as the chair of the public policy committee, I'm going to be testifying Monday afternoon in favor of the negotiated agreement and its importance to all hospitals. So we think a productive state session up to this point, but we're happy that it's winding down. Case.
Yeah, Mike, the amount that Jefferson Healthcare would get under the difficult to discharge patients, how do they figure out which hospital gets how much? Is that just done on a number of beds? Is that done on historical data of how many difficult patients we've had? And therefore, how do you figure out what percent of the SNAP should go to us, should go to these extended care facilities?
That's a great question, Case, and it points to I wasn't clear in describing all the moving parts and pieces. That there's the formal and the informal. The formal reason for SNAP is to offset the under reimbursement of Medicaid patients. So in its most pristine environment, every dollar that comes from the federal government through SNAP would go to hospitals based on Medicaid outpatient inpatient very complex formula that kicks off a number. The the environment that we are operating in is the state is allocating, say, 10% of that total Washington state SNAP amount, and then they are directing that into their coffers in order to give raises to those post-acute facilities. So in essence, rather than them finding the dollars to increase nursing home rates by 3%, they are redirecting SNAP dollars, thinking that, well, this will help hospitals. You said you needed this. So we're gonna help you meet that need by taking it off the top, putting in our general fund, and then using it to pay nursing homes more. So it's not that portion just goes right off the top to the skilled nursing facility and memory care reimbursement coffers. Okay, but happy that Olympia's about ready to wind down and looking forward to other things. Next slide.
So, Mike, what guarantee is there that we pay an extra, that we get a reciprocal amount back?
It's a year-by-year thing, but very good.
But what guarantee is there? Is there any firm language that if we pay in, we'll get it? You know, why not just increase Medicaid payments?
Because the state can't afford it. This is federal dollars, and it's dollars coming outside of the state's budget that allows them to do what they have to do for teachers and do what they have to do for other areas of the budget, but yet still allow for hospitals to get more money. Yes, Marian, in the short term, yes, but the state can do with this, the state can say, we're pulling out, we're not going to do this again. And then we would choose to stop taxing ourselves. But it's been a program that I've been involved in since my days at Olympic. And it's always worked as both parties planned and intended. But there is an element of risk.
Thank you.
Okay. So next is the first item that Dunya pointed out was our appropriations ask for our reproductive and gynecological health project. We have targeted outlined the expansion of the OBGYN clinic in our new building and one of the ambulatory surgery centers because it will increase access to women's care, including reproductive services. So we submitted an appropriations request to see if the governor and the state legislature would help fund that portion of the project. And commissioners Bueller and Dressler were kind enough to participate in an advocacy event with Representatives Theringer and Chapman, in the fall, where we first introduced this to them. And thus far, it's moved along well. We believe it's in the first draft of the House Appropriations budget. And Jill and I, as well as Drs. Skorberg and Lukman, are traveling down to Olympia on Tuesday to meet with Representatives Theringer and Chapman and Senator Van Wig to continue to reinforce how important this is to us, because it would be another $3 million, potentially $4 million. In the advocacy or grant funding bucket to help pay for our project. So we're feeling good about this request, but you never know until you know. with respect to these things, and we're gonna continue to impress our legislative delegation on its importance, and with all appropriate and due deference to Jill and Mari in their advocacy skills, Drs. Loopman and Skorbert are amazing advocates for additional investment in women's healthcare and in particular reproductive health services. So it's wonderful that they agreed to come down. Next slide, please. Federal, we're going to continue to focus on our fundraising. We have a bullet later in the slide. We've submitted our federal appropriations request for 2023 on an additional funding for our project. This focus will be on the expansion of critical services, specifically neurology, pulmonology, ENT, and geriatrics. Again, a subsection of our project that we have identified about a $2 million cost to build out. And we are in active discussions with our congressional delegation trying to get this appropriations request on a short list, because as you recall, this is what happened with our LINAC request through Senator Cantwell's office. Make application, you get on a short list, you work hard to get it on a shorter list, then the final budget is approved and your request is approved. We are working hard to get on that first short list with one of the congressional delegations, and we're feeling pretty good about it. But it's a lot of work in front of us, a lot of politics that have to be navigated. Unfortunately, beyond Washington, if it was just Washington politics, we'd be in good shape. But this is a federal request. But we've gotten good signals, and we like our chances. All right, next slide. And then we are also making a request for expanding healthcare for rural seniors, bringing needed specialty care to seniors in Jefferson County. And I think this is the project that the one pager for because neurology, pulmonology, ENT, it's certainly a service that will help our help take care of more of our population here locally. Next slide. ACO update. Dr. Mattern and he is back, is the good news. The challenging news is that his schedule for board meetings is he usually is not available till after 3:30, but he wanted to talk about the ACO and provide the update. And I think that if we are still if the meeting is still going on past 3:30, Dr. Mattern will be available and to give a presentation about this and some of the other things that he has been working on, which I think you'll find helpful. So I will defer in thinking that Joe indeed will be able to give the presentation. Next slide, please. So the org chart, third time up, and I think we got it right this time. We certainly do. We put the titles over the boxes, and I think this was in your packet. The titles over the right boxes, the Chief Planning and Advocacy Officer over Strategic Planning, Advocacy, Population Health, Care Transformation, and Marketing and Communication. The COO, Jake's job, the two long lines of services, then CFO and Chief Patient Safety Quality Officer, CNO Tina and CHRO at the far right. Our discussion, I think it was, we had it at the board level about foundation, are they or aren't they? And we looked at the bylaws, and there's certainly a connection to the org chart, but it could be argued that since they're their own 501c3, maybe the connection should be dotted. So that's how we are showing it now. And then CMO, General Counsel, CEO, and the board. So I think this is ready to go.
Well, in order to get discussion.
Is there a motion to approve this organizational chart?
Yes, so move. We approve this 2023 organizational chart.
And this, is there any discussion? All right, those in favor, raise your hand.
Actually, I did have one question, if I might.
Sure.
Not that I would expect you to change the chart, but I'm a little concerned about the long list underneath the COO. You acknowledge that those were two very long lists, and I'm wondering, yeah, those are two very long lists.
Yeah. Yes, we are. What's not being shown are the support positions to help with the boxes that make up the long list. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Jake's list are the clinics. And we are in the process of recruiting and have made an offer to an a director of primary care and a director of specialty care. So primary care, specialty clinics, outpatient surgery center, sleep lab, cardiovascular imaging, those represent all of our clinics scattered around the county. Those reports would be directly to these directors, and then the directors would report up to Jake. So I think it makes it more manageable with that. But you're right, Case. This is and I've talked with Jake about this, and the diagnostic imaging and ancillary services and our clinics just lend themselves. There's great value in the leadership cohesion of those two areas. But Jake and Dr. Butterfield and I talk about how we can continue to make this job manageable, because it's a lot, and it's a lot of important stuff.
And if I could just add to that, this is a great organizational chart, but it probably doesn't reflect all of the extra work that everybody has to do, given the project that we're undertaking during the next 2 years. So, that affects everybody's ability to do what they're doing, given potential moves and all of that and planning. So just my kudos for that being just on everybody's plate.
Noted.
Mar, did you have a question?
Well, this was in line with the advocacy next week down in Olympia. I would like it noted that until recently, till the coming of Dr. Lugman and Dr. Skorberg, that we really haven't had women's reproductive care as a department, a functioning full service department in the 35 years since I came here in 82. So I think there should be some emphasis on the fact that really this is the first, in the last couple of years, the first attempt to have a full service for women in this county. It took me 35 years of advocating for it, as Mike will no doubt attest, as will the previous Administrator Vic Dirksen.
Okay. I got my share of that advocacy, right. But it was well placed.
Well, it's very important,
yep.
Especially as women make the decisions regarding healthcare in general for families.
No, you can create the boxes, you can identify the space, but magic happens when you recruit providers like Dr. Scoreboard. Yep. So I could not agree more, and could not be happier than with the current team that we have.
Yeah, I endorse that wholeheartedly, Mike, because this is exactly what we've needed, is a couple of providers and their team.
Yeah, and the team. Yep, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. All right. So calling for the vote on the organizational chart. Everybody in favor of adopting it, raise your hand. Matt, did you?
Aye, yes.
Okay. All right, it's unanimous. Thank you. Okay.
All right, please. Thank you.
Oh.
Is that all for your report?
Nope. I've got a few more things.
Okay.
So, replacement and expansion project. We are closing in on finishing the design development phase of the project. That is going from sort of concept. Layouts to pretty specific design of both external and internal. And the next phase is construction grade. So design development sort of shows what you're going to build. Construction grade is how you're going to build it. And we're probably a few weeks out from that. There will be a comprehensive presentation on the project at your next board meeting. The design team has been started working a couple weeks ago on putting together detail-oriented as possible. View of what it is we're going to build. So lots of renderings. In a couple of cases, they have 3D software that you will be able to visualize in kind of some of the high traffic turning points, how the building will come together and what things will look like when you move from when you move from the ESSB to the new building. Cafeteria, radiation therapy, ambulatory surgery centers, OBGYN clinic, and then elevator up to the second floor. So I think it will be give you as clear as we have shown you to date what it is we're going to build. So that's that is scheduled for next April's board meeting, and I'm looking forward to it. In addition, we are in advanced stage of our discussions with USDA and the city of Port Townsend in sort of pre-permitting and pre-submission of application steps in the process. So the USDA is, excuse me, very deliberate about the steps that they take, and we hope to hear from them any day now on, you know, okay, we've reached this one milestone, and here's the plan going forward. There's been multiple meetings with the city and with our project team to understand all of the kind of outside of the construction footprint implications of this project, traffic studies, parking, stuff that you didn't necessarily think you needed to be concerned about, but we are concerned about. So that process is moving along, and I think on a weekly basis, there's There's information being shared between Jefferson Healthcare, our project management team, and the city of Port Townsend. So I think we're in a good place. I will feel better, you know, when we when these processes that we are engaged in are complete. But they take time. But we've got a great team, and I'm confident we'll get there. The pharmacy transition. As some of you may know, Lanny Ture is retiring. Next end of the month is his last day at the hospital. We brought in Cardinal, which is a pharmaceutical consulting firm, about a year ago, to help us with sort of an assessment of the entire pharmacy. Sort of like, hey, are there some things that we can do different and better? And in particular with our 340B program and our retail pharmacy program and the specialty pharmacy program, a lot of complexity in those programs, and Cardinal has resources to help us with that. We have extended that agreement from consultation to administration, where the pharmacy director is going to be employed by Cardinal, and the rest, but the department employees will be employed by us. So it's a way for us to tap into the expertise of a company that is well known and well regarded in the pharmacy provision business, but yet still maintain control of the department, because this is, it's complicated stuff. You know, each month we show you an income statement with a 340B line item, and you would have no idea of all of the machinations that go into making that that program and the finances of that program work. It's Cardinal's business, and frankly, we got into the retail pharmacy business because we thought we could serve Port Ludlow better, but also it allowed us to develop another revenue stream, and then it allowed us to get into the specialty pharmacy business, which is a high revenue business that if we don't do ourselves, some other company does, and the revenue associated with the specialty drugs leaves our community. So I'm looking forward, and they already have been very helpful in working with us to improve medication security and compliance in some other areas. So I wanted to make you aware of that change, and most importantly, just a chance to give Lanny a shout out. I think he's been here 8 years. Has always been a shining light in pharmacy. During the pandemic, where we didn't know how much vaccination we were going to get, or where it needed to go, or how it needed to be diluted, it was not uncommon for Lanny to be jumping in his car, driving to either deliver or pick up vaccinations, and just making sure that crazy time had a degree of pharmacy oversight and Lanny sanity. Huge kudos to him and what he's contributed to Jefferson Healthcare, in addition to just being a hell of a nice guy. And we wish him well in his retirement. Healthier Together update. You probably saw the piece in the newspaper today. As I had mentioned earlier, we are involved in this discussion and made a contribution to fund the design team And during the preliminary talks, offered to consider a portion of the orchard property for this project. We were thinking that if depending on how comprehensive of a health and wellness center the group decided it wanted to develop, a full service YMCA like facility a stone's throw from the hospital would be pretty cool. So it was a little bit of enlightened self-interest in this might be a spot for that facility. As you may have noticed in today's Peninsula Daily News, the city and Carrie, led by Carrie Height, they're doing a great job of seeking public input. Had a open house earlier in the week, or maybe last week, and sought community input. And the location that the community prefers, at least up to this point, is Mountain View. For all of the same reasons why the first pool and facilities were cited there. Proximity to to lots of different things on the transportation line, mass trans lines, and it seems to make perfect sense. They're far away from making a decision, but some of the most important elements that they will consider upon making that siting decision, the Mountain View property is a much better alternative than our property. So I think we're going to continue to participate in the process, because I do think whether it's just a pool replacement project or pool replacement with additional health and wellness and exercise amenities, that's good for the community, and it will be good for those of us in the business of keeping our community healthy and well. So we're going to stay at that table and continue to provide input. But I wanted to let you know, it looks in the initial feedback from the community is the Mountain View site may be the preferred site. And that concludes my report.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's great. Lots of good information there. And as you say, kudos to Lanny for such a great job all these years.
Yeah.
And he also served on the foundation, did he not?
He did. Yep.
So he volunteered for that too. Mm-hmm. Just an all around great guy.
Yes, he's currently still on the foundation board as part of the transition executive committee, and he's done a sterling job. He always volunteers. And in fact, over the years, he's paid to have a musician when we had the foundation trip on the vessel during the Wooden Boat Festival. I think if I recall, Wellhearts and also the Wreath event festival. So Lanny has been served well on the foundation board, and I'm hoping there's some way that he can continue. Hopefully he'll have more time with his retirement. That would be great.
Right. So, well, it sounds like you've got some talking to do to him, Mari. Keep him on. Casey, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, first of all, I second everything everyone has said about Lanny. He's been a great addition. Mike, in terms of the pharmacy, I'm assuming then that this person who is an employee of Cardinal will report operationally to Jake still, to the COO. Is that correct? And that is the mechanism whereby we will still have control over what happens, but it will be run by an expert.
Yeah, it's mostly we wanted a steady dotted line to Cardinal and the resource and oversight that they could provide. So that's why we chose this model. But absolutely, that it's. I'm trying to think of another example where there's a another facilities we outsourced biomedical engineering, and the director of biomedical engineering was an employee of AMSCO, but you would never know it. They reported up to up through the facilities and chief engineer. And that person report up to administration. So exactly, Case.
And I did have one other question, if I might, about in the advocacy slides, the last one I think you showed an elderly person with a veteran's cap and on oxygen. And this is for services including pulmonary or respiratory. A pulmonologist, perhaps.
Yeah.
What is the amount of money in that ask? I don't recall that specifically having been mentioned before for that particular funding.
$2 million. And
that's another two.
Yeah, it's just in it's the next the next round of federal appropriations and I think we just submitted it a couple of weeks ago. So it's okay. It's relatively new, and then they kind of grind their way through the wheels of Washington, D.C.
Okay.
So we'll keep you posted.
Okay. So, Mike, to return to Cardinal, so it's joint control and joint responsibility.
No. Mm-hmm. Our control. Our responsibility. They are staffing the position, but we are in charge.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And will that be one staff person, or is this going to? Okay.
Yeah, just the director.
I mean, this will be this isn't going to be a rotating number of people at Cardinal. This is one person with whom we have a relatively long-term contract, so we're not dealing with
it's one of the candidates is an existing Jefferson Healthcare pharmacist. It's a way to maintain direct control and authority, but also have this more elegant dotted line to the Cardinal the Cardinal resources We just feel that this model accomplishes both.
I just have some historical experience where some outside entity had a rotating door of people providing some kind of service, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, and I've had the same disastrous experience.
Not here.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Great report. It looks like Heather's here. And we also are scheduled to take a break about this time. We can go ahead with Heather's report and then take a break and wait for Dr. Mattern to come back. Sounds like maybe a good plan if he would be here. So, Heather, are you ready for your report?
Sure. Yes, I'm happy to talk about this. This is a great topic. Thanks for asking to hear about this. And I do apologize for my lateness. I was in with the DNV and we got in some really juicy conversations. So I wanted to make sure that I was in there for that and could represent on the people side of things. So, all right, Christina is going to share the deck. So I am not driving. Thank you, Christina. I appreciate that. Just a few slides, guys, to really show you the, it's not just about effort, it is about results. So I'm a believer that a couple things, you know, a lot of people can talk about what they're going to do and they can talk about how to make things great or how to make things better. But I am definitely one of those people that says, you know, show me the results, get me results. And I have to say to this team, you know, to first the talent acquisition team and the HR team, that they have really stepped up to the standards that I've set for them. And in addition to our hiring leaders, who we've asked to work differently to so that we can all accomplish the goal of reducing our vacancy rate. So just philosophically, Mike and I talk about this on the first slide here. We both agree that you can't, the core key to our culture really is around our people, clearly. But if you don't have enough people, that can really be a detriment to the culture in your organization. People are extra tired. People are worn down. There's not, you know, leaders are filling and plugging holes, if you will, and they don't have time to drive engagement and develop their teams. So we really believe that effective talent acquisition strategies that attract that top talent and do it in a really efficient and effective manner, that's what allows us to build the culture more efficiently and more effectively. And that helps the culture to take hold. When you have lots of openings, people can feel it. It can be demoralizing. It can weigh you down. And, you know, we've come a long way in the past few months, which I'll show you here in a second. But we know that the key is to get those positions filled, and not just what we call butts in seats, but the right people in the right roles at the right times. Next slide, please. So we started off to the right side of the slide. You'll see that in the fall of 2020, I came on November 1st. We had about 150 open positions. And so for an organization that's around 830 people, that should be around 1,000-ish, that's a lot of openings. Since that time, you can see our month over month, start from the bottom and work your way up. Our month over month success at filling these jobs. So in the month of November, we filled a total of 43 positions. And you see the legend there, new hires are in the lighter blue, and I'm colorblind. God, I hope they are blue. The lighter blue is our new hires, and then the darker blue is our internal transfers. So lots of internal promotion, lots of transfers happening within the organization as well. December, we filled an additional 26 positions. January, 32 positions, and we've remained consistent with February coming in at around 34 positions. So really 130 positions filled. Now that you might think, oh, well, great, we have 20 openings. No, 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 there's always a hole in the bucket. And there's always retirement, and there's always people going out on a medical leave, and then they can't come back. So there's an ongoing flow. I like to show a funnel of people of our people process that starts with our talent acquisition team at the top. Those are our recruiters. That's all they do is recruit talent. So, and I'll tell you how we got here. Was to really completely reconfigure what we were doing in recruiting, which we now call talent acquisition. Recruiters are now actually recruiting for talent, and that's super, super important. We've had support from SLG, the leadership team out there, Mike, everybody putting new systems in place. So it really has been a team effort, but we are making lots and lots of headway. So that's our first slide that shows kind of starts to tell the story. Next slide, please. So when you have that type of progress, you end up with a steady decline of open positions. So to date, we've reduced that by 23%. You can see a steady decline going down from, you know, we're looking at open positions in total. And then we're looking at what we are calling our total benefited or our critical positions, wanting to keep those below 100. And then we have non-critical positions, important, but they're more per diem or temporary, that obviously we are functioning without, but we're really focused on those benefited, you know, full-time FTE 0.9, 0.8, 0.6.
lost Heather. Heather?
We won't count that as an employee lost to services.
Oh, good. That was good, Case. Christina, do you know?
I just let her know that she died. She's restarting, I think.
Okay, great. There you go.
I died.
Welcome back.
I died. Sorry, guys. So you can see that we've reduced our open positions by 23%, which is not to say that the temp or the per diem positions aren't important, but we really need to get those full-time positions filled. We are filling some of those, as you can see, but we really want to focus on those benefited roles that really are going to get the most help and reprieve to our current staff and teams. Next slide. Please.
Could you say something about the non-critical versus in that previous slide?
Yes.
There?
So we're just internally amongst SLG and HR, we're referring to the critical roles as those that are full-time, they're benefited positions, right? Because if you're a 0.6 or greater, 0.5 or greater, you're going to be here more, and we want to get those filled as quickly as possible. That's where a team is going to feel the biggest bang for the buck when we get somebody in the door that's working multiple shifts versus hiring a per diem person that might work two shifts a month. So we're just saying a lot of our emphasis is on those benefited positions.
So when you say non-critical, you mean non-benefited?
I mean, it looks to me like that day you would only need to move a postdoc.
I started this because when we began to pay attention to, like, holy smokes, I've never seen 150 open positions before. That's a thing. Let's get our arms around this and start measuring it. And that number would very widely and wildly. So I would be paying enough attention to where I'd know we would make a lot of hires, and then we'd also, you know, we'd also be monitoring retirements and terminations closely to monitor the net. And my gestalt would be, we made progress this week, but then the number would be like 175 or something. And come to find out, there would be like 10 temporary positions posted for this particular role, or four or five per diem MAs because to trying to build a bullpen. And though I was less concerned about building a bullpen of per diems and more concerned with the open 0.6, 0.8, 0.9 ACORNs, ICORNs, OBRNs, RADTECs, MedTECs. So we fumbled around with trying to distinguish one from the other. We still pay attention to the bigger number, but our focus mostly is those FTE positions that there's a spot for, that a Jefferson Healthcare colleague is depending on that person showing up on a regular basis. So that's the intent of distinguishing one from the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Mike. So the next slide just tells you how we did it. It was interesting to me that we would have about 150 openings. I wasn't sure what was happening or how that was possible, but I was able to piece it together and learn that, you know, it was taking HR 3 weeks to get offers out to leaders, and I didn't understand what the process was. But once I got the team in the room and we mapped it all out, we learned. Hey, Kirsten, can you go on mute, please? Kirsten Golden. Thanks. What we learned was that we needed to retool the entire talent acquisition process, soup to nuts. And so we implemented new methods of sourcing. So we started with teaching the recruiters through a little boot camp that I threw together on how to source talent. So prior to that, what we used was, and we jokingly call it post and pray. You post a job on the website, you send it out to Indeed or LinkedIn or wherever it goes, and then you sit back and you hope that people are looking for jobs in Port Townsend, and then they apply to our jobs. That's not how TA works now. So talent acquisition professionals have to be proactive. And so I taught them how to use Boolean algorithms, dark web ways to look, not classic dark web, but I'm joking, but like ways to get deep into the internet to find people's personal information so that we can touch them directly and get them with their personal phone numbers, their personal email addresses, and sell the organization. People that are not looking for jobs, those are the ones that we want. We want to go find them and attract them. So we really did put a lot of effort and energy into teaching the recruiters how to go do that. We're now partnering in in a very fast and furious way with marketing. So hopefully if you're watching, you'll see that Amy's been a great partner. She and Tina have been blasting our openings all over the place, which we really, really appreciate. We get traction, and she's also keeping track of metrics. I like to call it, in marketing, you have what's called your customer acquisition cost, your CAC. I call it our PAC. What is our people acquisition cost? And so working with Amy so that we can determine what that number is and determine what our conversion rate is. Conversion is important in the world of talent acquisition. Let's see. Another big thing that we've done is to create nurturing of candidate relationships. So while we may not get that person that we're looking to source, we are building a relationship with them. So in a year from now, they'll remember us when our recruiter has it on a tickler to reach out to that ICU nurse or that surge tech that didn't want to come on right now because he wanted to wait for his kids to graduate. We're going to ping him in a year. So we're building these relationships so that people were top of mind. And you might notice on Facebook, specifically on LinkedIn, I've got my recruiters talking about the organization. They're making comments, they're networking, they're building their brand and the Jefferson brand on LinkedIn. We've also asked our hiring leaders to do the same. So some of our hiring leaders are sharing this information on LinkedIn as well as Facebook. And the truth is, while we can do all of this on the HR side and completely retool the process, it takes everybody. So we used a pilot to bring we started with three leaders. We brought three leaders into the new process. And the new process consisted of recruiters recruit and leaders lead their departments. And the recruiters will source for you as a hiring leader, will place the interview, will interview for you, will put them on your calendars, and you and your team show up. And that really allowed us to take control of dispositioning candidates. We can now begin to track our time to fill. And the hiring leaders that are in the pilot have time to lead their departments, and they don't have to go through every single applicant and try to determine who they should be interviewing. That's really not how the process should be set up. And so now we've got about 90% of our leaders into the new process that started out as a pilot. And so just a huge kudos to Tina, Jake, Brandy, Tyler. Thank you for your support. You guys, I know it was something that was very different, but your leadership team has really embraced it. We're still working out some of the kinks, but you can see that the results speak for themselves, and the leaders have been fantastic partners with us on that. So it's really been a team effort. Any questions on the how or the different things that we put in place to make it happen? Nope. Okay. I don't know. Is there another slide, Christina, or was that it? Oh, projections. Okay. So using the same, methodology, so far we're down to a 23% decrease. If we keep going with the same average number of positions that seem to get posted every week, we should continue to see a reduction down to 30%, a 30% reduction by June. So that's our target. If we focus on retaining the right talent, we can kind of put a plug in the hole in the bucket. but you know, we're averaging about one or two separations per week. Again, some of those are retirements, some of those are medical, some are for performance, and some are voluntary, but we are tracking that as well. I think that's it.
Thank you.
Great. Case?
Yeah, thanks very much. That's a very hopeful report, and I think that's great. I'm assuming that in those last charts, when you're talking about the reduction in open positions, you have factored in the number of positions that become open because there's an internal transfer. Because on your very first slide, you talked about, you know, 130 people coming in, but only 85 of those were actually new hires.
Right.
And the remainder of those were actually transfers, which then leaves an open position.
That's right. Yes, we are watching that. We realize it's a good problem to have when you can grow your own and promote talent. But Case, your thoughts are not lost on me. We're watching that and managing it to make sure that we don't lose sight and get overly excited about data like that. So we'll keep you posted. Matt.
Yeah, I'm just curious, are these people coming from our geographic region, or are we like reaching out further than in the past?
Yeah, we are all the way on the East Coast. We're down in Florida, we're in Arizona, we're in Michigan. We now do business in states that we didn't used to do business in. The talent pool is just different. We've got several roles that we've opened up to remote workers because that's just the wave, and that's how we're going to bring in top talent, because people have choices. So yeah, Matt, it used to, back in our day, Matt, we would just post a job and hope that someone local, you know, had the skills and we would bring them in. But now we can really pick and choose when we open up more of these non-patient facing positions. Yes.
How about overseas? I know that there are many countries that have highly trained health professionals, and I'm just wondering whether that's an option for us. In a clinic where I worked, we had an OBGYN from Iran. We had a surgeon from Venezuela. We had a physician assistant from Guatemala. I mean,
so baby steps, Case. we are on the in the beginning stages of just opening up nationally. I can tell you that no, we aren't reaching out to people internationally or looking to sponsor visas or looking to bring people over. But who knows what the future brings? Maybe that's something that Mike and team decide that we want to cast an even wider net. But for now, we're not there. We're just to the East Coast. That's as far as we've gone.
I hate to mention it, Case, but some years ago, we tried to recruit OB nurses from overseas, and the immigration, the visa issue, I'm sure has not got any easier. It was a challenge back then, and I'm going back a couple of decades, but it's really a long-term headache, I believe, to go through that process.
And it's expensive. It's actually very expensive to sponsor people. And I don't know, it just depends if that's the business you want to get into.
Maybe I'll start working on some of my cousins in the Netherlands, and I'll see what I can come up with.
Well, Case, I'll join you because I've been working on a trainee RN in Australia. When she graduates, she'll have a home here and she can do a couple of years here.
All right.
Already working on that.
Good.
Well, thank you, Heather. Very, very uplifting report again. That's nice.
Great. Well, thanks. My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. All right. Is Dr. Mattern available? Do you think he'll be available?
I think he's on his way. So a break now. I told him you guys would be breaking from about 3:50 to 4, and that would... and he would probably be calling on him shortly thereafter.
Okay, so
he just said, well, I'd be first up. And I said, I think that you'll just keep an eye out for him and when he appears, because he's he has I mean, I think certainly ACO comments, but he just has a perspective on he looks at things, the House, from a different lens than I do. And I think that's a perspective that you have been missing the last couple of months. So yes, he's ready definitely. to just do that.
Well, welcome him back, that's for sure. All right, yeah. Then we will take a break and now we will return at 4 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.
You are.
All right, welcome back to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. And we will begin this section with Dr. Joseph Mattern, who we are welcoming back and anxious to hear your report.
Welcome, Joe. It's nice to be back. We'll talk a little bit about kind of capacity and just sort of an update on some areas just from clinical capacity. One of them will be palliative and care and hospice, which is typically on Wednesday afternoons what has taken my attention away from the board meeting. So glad I could carve out a little time this afternoon though. So first, just as I usually do, I usually give you an update on all things kind of COVID and respiratory illness. So I thought we'd just kind of talk, because there's some, you know, big things that are coming up at the end of this month, beginning of April, with the DOH mandate on masking in healthcare facilities going away. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about kind of what the discussions that are happening here. First thing, though, I wanted you all to be aware of is earlier this week in a conversation with Dr. Berry, she was in agreement that flu season is essentially over at this point. The levels of influenza cases have been quite low. RSV cases petered out a while back. So really right now, the main transmissible illness in the community that we still have a focus on is COVID. Though it's obviously we're at a much different time in the pandemic. And the discussion for the last couple of weeks has been in preparing for the change in the state mandate around masking in healthcare facilities. We knew this was coming, caught the health officers a little bit by surprise in how it was announced, and it caught organizations a little bit off guard with no real formal guidance kind of moving forward. So organizations are kind of all doing a little bit different thing, but trying to kind of stay similar enough to one another. So some of the discussions that we're having, it was actually nice having the DNV survey team here, because they've been throughout the country, and so they've seen facilities where there's no masking of, you know, patients or clinicians, and they've seen other places that are sort of a hybrid, and so it was interesting getting their perspective of kind of what's happening nationally. And, you know, Washington is one of the later states to lift any sort of mask mandate. So the infection control team is the team that really kind of makes the final recommendations. And so we had a meeting earlier this week, and there should be a survey out among that group, trying to kind of come to some final conclusions on some things. What I would kind of anticipate, and what you're seeing across the region, is that there will probably be, particularly for the employees of a healthcare facility, some ongoing masking in patient care areas and with patient-facing duties. There is still enough COVID around. There is enough concern that we don't want to carry even a small risk of causing having a patient come in and get COVID from their healthcare provider or healthcare team in our setting. So we're kind of finalizing sort of the areas and what that would look like. I'm anticipating some lifting of masking in non-clinical areas. One of the questions will be whether your vaccination status will determine your ability to unmask or not in those areas. Similar to our flu policy, that would be in line with our influenza policy, which is if you're not vaccinated for influenza during flu season, the anticipation, you know, pre-COVID was that you would be masking when you're at work. And so so there's some discussion around that. So I would anticipate that there is a blend. I think I'll just kind of let you all know, I think community-wise, there's a real mix of feelings that I'm sure you see as you go about the community. There's some people say, like, you know, I got vaccinated, I'm kind of done with this thing, it doesn't, you know, worry me anymore. I have patients who come in who ask me to remove my mask so that they can hear me better. It's easier to communicate, to see my face, and there are patients who are going to be the other end of the spectrum who are not going to be pleased to see that masking is getting lifted in some areas of healthcare facilities. So so we're going to try and, you know, strike the right chord with this and see if we can, you know, continue. At the end of the day, we want to protect patients. We also want to preserve our staff because we still, you know, we're seeing it this week that we can have outbreaks of illness and we can see, you know, departments get short pretty quickly. So I think we need to be mindful about how we move forward. But we also have a fair amount of appetite among our staff to not have to mask continually when we're at work, particularly in non-patient facing spaces. So anticipate some new guidance coming out from for the organization in the next 1 to 2 weeks here in anticipation of the deadline. So no final conclusions, but that's my little bit of a preview of what I think where things are going to land. The other thing that's going to make the situation a little bit more complicated, which is that community prevalence and Casey, you may mention this when you talk about your public health board report, but the local data is really going to be going away. There's not the resources and the funding to continue to collect data at a more local county. And so our understanding is that data is going to be rolled up to the state level. So that really state prevalence is what we will be seeing for disease prevalence, and that we'll have less information at the local level besides what we see with our own testing. Of course, we're not always going to be getting the full picture because more and more people test at home and don't make use of our services. So we won't have the same, unless there's an outbreak in a specific area, we're not going to have necessarily the same line of sight on community prevalence. Again, for us, luckily, because of the high vaccination rate in our community, we are in a place where, again, we don't see severe illness with COVID like we did in the early part of the pandemic. So so that's what to anticipate there. Few things around medical staff. I want to make you aware that the bylaw revisions, I believe, are going through legal review. So I mentioned this a couple times before, that there was a slow but steady progress in doing a review of the bylaws and updating bylaws. There will be some changes, some expansion to medical staff leadership positions. There's a desire to expand participation in certain subcommittees. And mostly overall, it's just going to be kind of bringing up, bringing the language in the bylaws to better reflect what we look like now as an institution. So at some point that'll be in front of you, and just want to make you aware that that is getting closer to finalization. On the staff leadership side, another event, just let you know, so you're familiar with the fact that there's been a lot of investment in leadership positions for directors and managers through the Huron work, formerly Studer. So we felt that for our physician clinician leadership, that training wasn't quite center of the target for what our medical directors need. So for our chief medical officers and for our medical directors, we think that there does need to be leadership training because oftentimes clinical leaders, we find ourselves kind of in these positions because we showed up at the meeting, we seemed to do a good job, we seemed to be able to, you know, work with, you know, folks, and but we don't come in with formal leadership training. And so we would like to change that. It was something we were talking about pre-COVID, and now we're getting back to a commitment that we had made before we got, you know, sidelined by the pandemic. So one of the things that we're going to do is some ongoing educational events. And so we have a day and a half at the end of April where we're bringing the medical directors together to do some more formalized training. We're going to use some outside resources to help that have some good good modules that we think are appropriate for what our medical directors need. So with the former Greeley group, now the Chartis group, they've got a speaker that is in our region. She's out of Virginia Mason in Seattle. So she's nearby. So she's going to come over and do some work with the team. And then we're also going to have one part of the second day will be focused on wellness and trying to build that into part of our leadership training. The idea being that if we can train our leaders how to focus on wellness and sustainability and resiliency, then there's a trickle-down effect for the rest of the staff too. So this is an opportunity to kind of get some concepts in front of our medical leaders about some self-care and sustainability. So we're excited about that. Along those lines on the wellness side of things, the last quarter, we had dinner and a question, which was kind of three nights of dinners for colleagues to get together and connect with one another. That was a success. I think we'll be looking to repeat that again in the next quarter. We hope to make it a regular event. We'll be looking for some opportunities for some all staff education as well in the next few months. We already have a date set for the annual symposium for the medical staff as well. So we'll be looking to repeat that again in October. So I think those events are great. Again, trying to get people reconnected with one another is a big part of what helps, you know, keep people going in doing this very hard work. So expect more of that. And then we typically, particularly for some of those learning events, I know oftentimes we like to get the board involved too. So we'll make you aware. Lastly, I just want to kind of end on just kind of talk a little bit about capacity across the region. Again, things continue to be tight, though they are better than how they were. We had a medical executive meeting, and there was some discussion amongst the medical leaders that sensed that getting patients transferred out of from the floor and out of the emergency department was maybe a little bit easier than it had been in previous months. But it's a pretty week to week, day to day situation. So it can get bad pretty quickly. One of our local partners was has been going through some difficult times where sometimes they're diverting patients to us. They'll call and see if we can take a few patients. So it can be difficult if you get a hospital in your region that is, you know, just does not have capacity. There's a ripple effect. And so we will feel that at different times. So complex behavioral health patients still continue to be a challenge. We've done some recent debriefing with some community partners to talk about these cases, because sometimes the problem isn't necessarily local in how we manage this. We're sometimes running into difficulties with institutions in King County in particular in trying to place individuals. And so we're trying to make sure that at least locally, we're all on the same page about how to manage these patients and how we communicate well with one another, because that behavioral health patient placement in Washington State continues to be an issue. And we know those patients, you know, oftentimes the Jefferson County patients, they'll start in our emergency department. Locally, as far as capacity, you know, you might be hearing in the community difficulty with capacity in certain areas. Primary care goes up and down depending one clinic or not, depending on who might be out. We have if we have an individual who's on leave, depending on staff, if we have some illness running through a staff or a pod. So it's, you know, again, you might hear in the community kind of variability, ability to get in. We do have at least one recruitment position for a physician assistant right now for the Sheridan Clinic. That's open. We are fortunate, though, that we have a practitioner at South County who's begun to see patients and is working also with Port Ludlow. So it's nice to have a long-term plan in place, particularly for South County. So, you know, we, you know, solve a problem in one area and then, you know, sometimes find ourselves short in another. Regarding other specialties, oncology, we have, you know, Dr. Murphy has extended her time before retirement. So she's putting in a little more time, but we're trying to help and work towards a transition. We'll actually be making use of some telemedicine services with a organization called Eagle Telemedicine that has a working relationship with the Rural Collaborative. So that will be starting next month, I think is on track. So you may be hearing more about that. And that's a way to supplement our in-person oncology services. We did add another nurse practitioner to the oncology department, but she is just getting going. And so her capacity is going to build up slowly. We have an ongoing recruitment to try to shore up kind of long-term the staffing on the ground there, particularly Dr. Murphy at some point really does want to retire. And then other places, dermatology access, again, is very limited. Dermatology is really asking, particularly for routine skin examinations, they don't really have much capacity. So they're really asking folks to see their primary care clinician, and they're still trying to work in more acute care or, you know, referrals that come because of a specific need. So there is some recruitment going on to again, try to, you know, long-term build out access to that service. So slow going so far on that, but hopefully we'll have some success. Palliative care, we continue to recruit to add a nurse practitioner in. It's been falling to me, which has not been easy. So I have one additional physician who helps me with hospice, but we've been carrying several patients on a wait list because of hospice staff limitations. That seems to be improving. So I think we're able to admit a few more patients on, and hopefully we'll have a bit more capacity with some nursing hires and FTE increases. So it's just very tight right now. So we're trying to triage and get the most acute needs met first, but some limitations still there. ED and Express Clinic continue to be very busy. The good news there is that we've committed more to double staffing with clinicians in those departments on more days. And so I think that's helping the flow, particularly during the daytime, because Express Clinic can easily see up to 40 patients. And if you just have a single provider seeing that, it can be a really a heck of a day. So more consistently trying to have particularly the busy days double staffed, and same thing during the peak hours of the emergency department during the day, because not only can the numbers get quite high, but the complexity of the patients, since we have the Express Clinic model, it's not a lot of coughs and colds and, you know, runny noses that are coming to the emergency department. The folks who are there are high acuity patients, and so they take more energy from our ED staff. So but we're hanging in there, you know, comparatively to other organizations. I'm sure if it hasn't been said by Mike already this meeting, we'll take our problems over some other folks. So still things to work on, but overall we're hanging in there. So I'll be quiet now and see if you had any questions about any of that.
Laurie, do you have a question?
Yes, Dr. Madden. I heard something about a new hospital being proposed or being built on the grounds of Western State. Are you familiar with that? And would that help our behavioral health issues that we have? Or is it just for those incarcerated Washingtonians that need more behavioral health kind of work than
yeah,
actual
any,
physical
any stuff. Increase I don't know about that specific plan. I've heard different things here, and I'm never sure kind of what's proposed or what's actually kind of being planned. The state needs a long-term movement to have more inpatient bed capacity. There's a couple things that we find are difficult. So the bed capacity, it's not even just about building beds, because beds without someone to actually, the properly trained staff and, the psychiatrists, the psychiatric nurses, the techs, all the other stuff that goes with working with this population. The state needs a plan to build capacity. The movement away from the state psychiatric hospital system, you can understand, it's more to community-based care. You can understand why people wanted to move that direction away from the old state mental health hospital. But it didn't really take into account the fact that severely mentally ill, particularly folks in crisis, unstable situations, that there's a limit to what community-based care can achieve. And so one of the things that we're finding, again, that the hardest patients to transfer are oftentimes geriatric patients who need guardianship, and there's issues around decision-making capacity, patients who have complex coexisting medical conditions, and then really sometimes violent patients who unfortunately are significant risk of harm to themselves or to other people who need to be restrained. These are the people who really need the behavioral health equivalent of intensive care. And we're finding that there's not the bed capacity there. And then to complicate that, there are things in the Washington state law, again, well-intentioned to protect patient autonomy, that however have been either interpreted or having kind of unintended consequences of making it difficult for these patients to be placed in the proper setting and receive the care that they need. So we can continue to do what we can from the local level, right? You think about some of the things that we've done with safety rooms in the emergency department, the use of telepsychiatry on the inpatient setting, working with our, trying to have a tighter relationship with our community mental health agency. And those are really important things, because these patients oftentimes are here and we don't, we can't get them elsewhere. And certainly when, we have that tight partnership with the with DBH and with the DCRs, it's more likely we're going to get folks to the place that they need to be ultimately quicker. But what the capacity that's needed is just not there. The resources that's needed is just not there. And so and I think it's to your point, I'm not sure what the long-term plan is, Mari. I'm actually I'd feel better if I saw that this was the state plan moving forward, because it isn't just about building a building. There has to be a pipeline of the people who are going to staff that. And so we do see, we've begun to have some conversations again, that as amongst all the other advocacy we do with our state and our federal government partners, that this probably has to be another one that we need to revisit with them, to give them perspective. And we're not the only rural setting that's going through this. It's not just specifically Jefferson County. So
thank you.
Yeah, Case. Oh, you're on mute.
Case,
you're muted.
There you go.
There we go. Thank you.
We'll all do that years later. It all happens.
So, thanks for a very comprehensive report. First of all, I want to second what you said about Dr. Barry's report to public health and all of the complexities associated with reporting, and how it's becoming more and more difficult to really figure out what's going on. Second of all, I thought also today that you might be able to report on the ACO and where we are with that. Are you still willing and or able to do that?
Yes, you know, I was running from the hospice meeting to this meeting, and so I was quickly sketching down the sort of, oh, I got to remember to say these things, and I left out the one that I told Mike. I was like, oh, I should give the ACO report. That's right. So, yeah, well, it's good. Actually, it's probably good that I take a pause. Actually, I'll take any questions on anything else I asked, and I'm happy to give you a quick ACO-specific update. Any questions about anything else that I had so far? If not, once Dunia's back, she'll be participating again in the ACO reports when she's back from maternity leave. But I'll just give you a quick update. Again, we went live in January with the Jefferson Health ACO. And for the most part, that doesn't mean much other than the fact that we've, got some tasks that we have ahead of us right now to complete. One of them is beginning to notify beneficiaries that that Jefferson has an ACO that they are part of and what that means. So right now, I believe there's a draft communication that's going around about a way to a letter that we want to send to patients. We want to really, this is a 5-year commitment to be an accountable care organization for CMS. And this is a direction that CMS wants to move, right? They want to move away from fee-for-service to value-based care by 2030. And I think for most folks, people would say, what does that really mean? One of the things is that we have here is we have an opportunity to let the community know why we're trying to have a different model of care with Medicare and how we think that it actually better aligns with the way that we want to deliver care and is part of the long-term solution to Medicare. We want to make it clear to patients that this is not a Medicare Advantage plan. We want to make it clear how this is different than other accountable care organizations that other people have kind of heard about where there are third parties involved that have other interests, and that this is explained that this is a local initiative, and that we're doing it because we get to control how we deliver care. So we want to think about where our communication strategy will be kind of multi-pronged. One will be a communication to patients. So we're going to probably do that through drafting a letter, that process, like I said, is getting close. The other thing too is that we really need to educate our clinicians and our internal communication. People kind of say, oh yeah, I heard we're doing that ACO thing, and I think once we begin to kind of talk more about it, we also need to make sure that the clinicians, when patients arrive, they will ask them questions about what is this thing again? So we need to make sure that they're prepared. So we're going to begin a communication strategy that will actually be internal as well. And then we're making some plans that when sort of the ongoing identification and communication around the ACO as part, when people come into the clinic, how can we make sure that they're with their after visit summaries, that they're receiving information. So some of this is actually part of the agreement of being an ACO is that you commit to doing this communication to your beneficiaries. But we want it to be more than just simply a check the box of the, hey, we've told you you're in the ACO, you've been notified. What we really want to do is make sure that people understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. So that's the main focus right now. We've begun to receive some data from Medicare, which will give us a more comprehensive picture of the needs of our patient population. We're lucky in the fact that we have an enterprise-wide electronic health record like Epic, and that we have a multi-specialty group. So a lot of people will get a lot of, maybe all of their care at Jefferson, but once you leave Jefferson, we don't necessarily have line of sight on all the care that people need. And so we're going to get better data from CMS, so we have a better way to assess the risk of our patients, so we can better identify, again, who may need more attention, more support, so that they're less likely to end up with a hospitalization or a hospital readmission, make sure that we're clear-eyed on what all of our patients need. So we've begun some initial meetings of looking at that data, but that's going to be a process through the year. At some point, I anticipate we'll be presenting some of what we learn to the board, but that's going to be probably sort of, latter half of the year, I would anticipate. But we're lucky we got Sean Downing. I know he's on the call today, data analyst extraordinaire. And so he's already, he's got some initial strategies of how to work through the data and really give us some useful information moving forward. So that's the main, that's kind of where we're at right now. Yeah, go ahead, Case.
Yeah, you mentioned something about connecting with the patients. Do I understand it correctly that the patient doesn't have to do anything in particular to be part of this ACO? Or do they actually have to sign something that says, I want to be a part of this?
No, they don't. I think there is a way that a patient can specifically opt in, but mostly that based on their activity is how they're attributed. So typically what Medicare will look at and say, where do you receive most of your care? Or if they can clearly identify where a patient receives their primary care, oftentimes, for example, if you have an annual wellness visit with a provider or a clinic, they take that as clear identification that is your medical home, that's your primary care provider, and so that's your, where you should belong for an ACO. Otherwise, if that specific type of event doesn't happen, they look at where is the patient receiving the vast majority of their care, and they'll assign a patient retrospectively that way. So one of the reasons, a lot of organizations will focus on wellness exams is a way to make sure that they're capturing their patients in their accountable care organization, making sure that that patients are being seen for the primary care work, which also coincides with the real intention to focus on preventive care. But the wellness exam is only one way that's just one option of how you can do some of that preventive care. There are other ways without doing lots of wellness exams.
So if somebody comes into the clinic with a particular illness or concern, is there a way that you get flagged that says this patient is in our ACO? Or do you actually have to go digging and try to figure it out?
Right. One of the things that we're going to do on the clinical side is we're not really going to change the care to how we manage the patients, because you could get in this situation of are they, are they not? What we'd rather do is, as a clinician, I just need to know, do you view me as your primary care physician? And if so, well, then these are the things I do as your primary care clinician, right? So we're going to focus on prevention. We're going to focus on, chronic disease management. I'm going to try to identify if you need additional resources such as care coordination. And one of the things is that doing the Medicare ACO, it makes sense for us because we have such a large Medicare population. But really the type of care that we're talking about is really not, it's patient-based, it's not insurance-based. So whether you're on a, Medicaid managed care insurance or you're on a Blue Cross Blue Shield, really shouldn't matter. And that's where we want to get to. So we may have signed signed on for a program with Medicare, but we've been doing value-based care with Amerigroup, for example, have worked with them to say, hey, are our diabetics well controlled, who out there hasn't been in for an exam or gotten their blood work done, and who's, have these children gotten their well child check. So what we want to do is take that sort of, same view of primary care, and then eventually align, move more and more of those agreements with different insurances to look more like a value-based model. So rather than having kind of separate, well, we do things differently because you're, a Medicare patient, what we'd rather just do is say, hey, you're a patient who needs care coordination. And so care coordinator, we need to help them. And then on the back end, if we find that, well, that's, that patient's going to be attributed or their data is going to go to the Medicare ACO and this patient's going to go to the Regents ACO. It doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't not going to make a difference to us, hopefully, as much. On the care side, on the clinical side, what we want to do is get people who need more services, who need more care coordination, who need their care gaps closed. We just want to be doing that work. So does that kind of make sense?
Yes, but I think it makes a difference for Tyler whether or not somebody is coming. I see Tyler on here. Whether somebody is coming here to get a bunch of care, but Medicare has got them assigned somewhere else because somebody else thinks that they're the primary care provider.
Right. Yeah, our past, and he can definitely let Tyler chime in. This is oftentimes where that interest in that annual wellness visit, because it's sort of the one, it's the one visit that rules them all, as it definitely identifies or puts someone in your ACO. But again, we're lucky because we have the way that our health center is set up, and the way that people oftentimes end up with multiple visits within our organization, that when you look at how the history of how patients have been attributed, it has actually worked out well that with this retrospective that we still end up with a lot of the patients that we should in the ACO. So it is one of the strategies we'll be monitoring, because if we do find that there's a discrepancy between the patients we're taking care of and those who end up in the ACO attribution, we will have to take other measures to try to kind of get them in.
Tyler, do you have something to add?
Well, I was just going to add that exactly as Dr. Matterno was explaining, I mean, it's a retrospective look back. So they're constantly updating that roster to say, here's who we believe are going to be the patients that you're going to be held accountable to at the end of the year. But that doesn't change the clinical care at all. It's, we're basically, this is going to allow us to get credit for the work that we were already doing in terms of we're already doing all the clinical work focusing on wellness. Now there will be that look back over a 12-month period to say, okay, in the past year, these are the patients that had the predominance of their primary care visits with Jefferson mm-hmm. Healthcare. Most of their claim spend for primary care only was at Jefferson Healthcare. So you are accountable to them because they see the primary care as being, the quarterback of the spend, the one that should be accountable to it. So they'll look back over a certain period and say, this is who is on your final role. But that roster is going to change. It's about we don't have any of our data yet, so I don't know, but in usual ACOs, it's like a 20 to 30% churn rate, because you have to have those visits in that 12-month window. And so, people might not see their primary care every 12 months. And if that's the case, they'll come on and off of our roster. There is the ability to go in and say that Dr. Mattern is my primary care provider. But if you have traditional Medicare, there's very low odds that you have the time to sit on a call with CMS to say, Dr. Mattern is my primary care provider, when it gets you absolutely nothing. Now, you can call them and make that designation. And if you did, then you would always be on our roster, no matter how the claim spend worked itself out. But that's, a fraction of a percent of the people that actually go in and designate a primary care provider with Medicare, because there's no reason to do it. You can go anywhere, anyways. You don't have to have referrals to go places. So, and then we are required to give them the notifications. And the biggest reason that CMS wants us to do that, and the big piece that they have in their required notification, is that you can call them. You can say, I don't want any of my data shared with anybody, and so don't give my claims data to any ACO, to any individual. That's again something that very little people do, because you've got to call Medicare. There's no reason to do it, and so it's not something that happens very often, from what I've seen. But the rest of the required communication is pretty boilerplate. So we do want to have something that's got a lot more meat to it, a lot more, you know, frequently asked questions, other stuff to go to it to get people clued into what exactly we are doing and what this means to them, besides just a boilerplate, if you don't want your data shared, call this number situation. So we want to have more than that.
Thank you. All right. Good discussion. Is that any other questions for Dr. Mattern? Dr. Mattern, it's nice to have you back.
Yeah, we've good missed to be you. Back. Yeah, I'm hoping we'll be able to, you know, carve out the time a little bit more easily and you know, help Mike out so that way he doesn't feel like, you know, he has too much pressure on his reports to, you know.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Anything else, Ben? All right, then we'll move into board business and the Board of Health report. Case,
Commissioner Call. Thank you. First of all, just a quick notice that the first full week of April every year is National Public Health Week. So, you know, we should thank all the public health people we know and also count our blessings that we have an excellent relationship with a superb public health department here in Jefferson County. I did send to the board the report that I gave at the last Board of Health meeting. In that report, I spent part of the time talking about the presentation that Mike gave at the Maritime Center on March 8th, which was very well received, and stressed that the first half of his presentation was really focused on the cost that we have had in terms of the stress on our staff, our staffing during the last 3 years of having coronavirus around. I also referred to a New York Times article, and I quoted that and gave the link to that in the report that I sent to you. It's a report by the author, Dr. Atul Gawande, who currently works for the Global Health at the United States Agency for International Development. And the article is entitled, quote, "The aftermath of a pandemic requires as much focus as the start," end quote. And he specifically also talks about how unless we invest the resources that we did in the beginning, unless we continue to invest that in primary care and in our healthcare system, we're going to have a significant amount of trouble with any potential additional pandemic, not to mention we're not going to be able to pick up and improve the health of the people in this country because of the devastating results of the pandemic on the healthcare system. And he quoted that life expectancy in the United States has gone from 79 years to 76 years in the last 3 years. And an awful lot of that is because people can't get and or didn't get the kind of care that they need, not just related to the coronavirus, but to all other things. And so it's just a reminder to all of us how important it is for Jefferson Healthcare to survive financially and independently and continue to grow to meet the challenges of this community. And that's all I need to say. Oh, and I just want to say that next month we will be honoring the public health heroes every April. Jefferson County Public Health honors a number of people who have been nominated by the community for having done outstanding things to further the resilience of our community. So stay tuned and I will tell you who the nominees are at the next board meeting.
Hey, thank you, Case. Any other comments from board reports?
I would just like to remind everybody about the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation plant sale, which Amy just earlier on reminded me that it's not employees only, but it's been well advertised to employees. Starts this coming Saturday, rain, shine, snow, or anything else. 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. or 11:30. Bring your own equipment. Bring burlap. Bring plastic bags. And it's a dig your own deal to help support Jefferson Healthcare Foundation while we try and raise the $1.25 million towards the Linux Accelerator. And so you will, whoever shows up needs to bring cash or check, and the right money cash, please. We're not giving change. So if you've only got a 50 and you only want one ticket, that's a nice $30 donation to the foundation. So, sorry, you're laughing, Mike, you better be there too. So bring your own spades, buckets, and everything else, and have fun digging in the designated areas, which will be well marked, and there will be people on hand, apart from the foundation members, to help you not go astray. And it is a first-come, first-service, and also it is an honor system. So if you only paid for three, then you only take three. So.
And how much is each one? How much is each one? How much is each
well,
one?
Well, you get three digs for $20, depending on the size of the plant. Some plants or bushes or bigger things, I think, will be like one for 20. But that's all being priced out by, I guess, Kelly O'Connell and Amy Yaley. So talk to them about the pricing if there's an issue.
And when I made the announcement at the Board of Health meeting a month ago, they put it in the minutes as this is a groundbreaking ceremony. And I said, no, we're digging up plants. Thank you very much. That'll happen later.
It is still groundbreaking because it helps us break the ground properly.
And it's good exercise.
It is good exercise. And okay. Unfortunately for Dr. Madden, there will be no master gardeners on site to assist.
Okay. All right, great. Anything else? Okay, then let's go with the meeting evaluation. Maury?
A good meeting, a lot of excellent information. I think for the spring day with the beautiful sunshine and everything looking a little more positive, or maybe a lot more positive, I think this is a way to get into the new year and our project and get things taken care of.
All right, Matt?
Yeah, great meeting, and yeah, that's all I have to say.
Okay, Case?
Yeah, good meeting. I think it's hard to say it was a bad meeting with so many good news reports, everything from finances to recruitment and hiring to Joe Mattern being back. I mean, you know, what can go wrong?
Right. Mike, do you have a comment?
No. Thanks for working around kind of a frenetic schedule today, but I think we pulled it off.
Well, I thank all of you and all the staff for working around too, because it's, you know, it's not easy when everything is kind of disrupted by our surveyors in a good way. So thank you all. Yep. And then we can go ahead and entertain a motion for closure of this meeting.
So move.
Second.
There's second. Okay, discussion. All in favor of concluding this meeting, raise your hand. Thank you. See y'all later.
Thank you.